It started as writing. And right from the beginning, you knew this was different. Because it was happening in small villages, market towns. And then it wasn't on the TV anymore. It was in the street outside. It was coming through your windows. It was a virus, an infection. You didn't need a doctor to tell you that. It was the blood. Or something in the blood. By the time they tried to evacuate the cities, it was already too late. The infection was everywhere. The army blockades were overrun. And that's when the extras started.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus retrospective series, watching and reviewing 28 Days Later and its sequel, 28 Weeks Later.
The answer to infection. It's here, though it may not be quite what you imagined.
Hosted by Arnie.
He's telling me he'll never bake bread, plant crops, raise livestock. He's telling me he's futureless.
Stuart.
Am I one of them? No, you're not.
And Jacob.
I think they're good people.
Well, that's nice, but you should be more concerned about whether they're going to slow you down.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language. Listener discretion is advised.
It's all fucked. You hear it all on the radio. It's all fucked.
Today we're discussing 28 Days Later, starring Cillian Murphy, Nomi Harris, Christopher Eccleston. Damn it, I saw him before and didn't even know it. And directed by Danny Boyle. Hello! 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 I'm Arnie, co-host of Now Playing.
Stuart in LA.
This is Jacob. And listeners, repent. The end is extremely fucking nigh.
Almost, actually, it is. We got one more show for extra donors, but yeah, we are kind of coming to the tail end, but we maybe saved the best for last. I mean, I was excited to revisit some of the Return of the Living Dead and some of the Evil Dead, but I cannot wait to talk about these two movies we've got for you next here. 28 Days Later was my absolute favorite film of 2003. It was released in England in 2002, came to America next summer. I saw it, was blown away. I knew we had to do it one day. Yeah, there's this rumor that they're going to do a third part of the trilogy. I don't believe it. That's why we're doing it here now, right at the end, as we lead into World War Z. World War Z may be the 28 months later we'll never get. That's what I think. I think that this is the trilogy coming here at the conclusion, and one I'm excited to really talk about.
I'm with you, Stuart. I'm excited about these films, especially this one, 28 Days Later. I remember seeing this one opening weekend. 28 weeks later, it's been a while since I revisited that one, but I remember liking it, so we'll find out next week. But I'm excited for tonight to talk about this film.
And I'm right there with you guys. I did want to hold off for 28 months later because I'm also a fan of this series of films, and I just like to believe that Danny Boyle could return to it.
Well, you know, he did do some recent press for Trance, and someone asked him. He said that he may do it. I think everyone is waiting to see what World War Z does. If it makes a bunch of money, then yeah, we might get the big apocalyptic zombie from Danny Boyle. But right now, I think it's kaput.
Well, the other problem is the rights are held by two different companies or two different people who aren't speaking to each other. They couldn't make the movie if everybody wanted to. But Danny Boyle was really gung-ho, had a treatment, was ready to go in, I think, 2010 or 2009, and just wasn't able to make it happen because of these rights issues. So because of that and knowing how these rights issues can stymie movies that should happen for 20 years, and in this case, till it's not relevant, it would be a shame to not visit these films. So when I did that research and found that out, yeah, we definitely have to talk about 28 Days and 28 Weeks Later. This is the film that did it for me. I've mentioned during our other zombie podcasts, especially during Return of the Living Dead, in the 80s and 90s, I didn't get zombies. They weren't scary. They're about as scary as a mummy, you know? It's not at all. They walk around, they moan brains, they're slow and shambling. And when 28 Days Later came out, from the guy who did Trainspotting, saw a couple trailers, but didn't really feel like going because zombies, big whoop. And going and seeing this and the experience I had made me hungry for more zombie films and really revved up when Dawn of the Dead came out to see that opening weekend. So very excited to be able to talk about this movie this week.
It's not just you. This is the movie that really kicked off the zombie apocalypse, that brought us Walking Dead on television, that got us Dawn of the Dead remake, that let Romero have a big budget Universal sequel to Living Dead. All of it really can be credited to Danny Boyle. And it's funny, Arnie, Danny Boyle admits he hates zombie movies too. I don't think that he necessarily looks at these as a Romero take on the zombie. You know, I guess it all comes down to the fact that he made them fast and he made it a virus. And they were never conclusive in Romero where they came from or why, and they certainly never ran. But his instincts are right. We needed a reboot and a jolt to the genre, and that's what this does.
I agree, and we've had some listeners come to us and go, you know, your donation series isn't really a zombie series. Evil Dead, those aren't zombies. Those are demons. Return of the Living Dead, all right, those are zombies. 28 Days Later, those aren't zombies, they're infected. But that said, while Boyle may not be a fan of zombies, the writer of the film, Alex Garland, based this off of very specific George Romero imagery in many cases. So the post-apocalyptic vision, the infected, Garland got a lot of that off of Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead. So I think they're zombie enough.
Yeah.
I'm typically the zombie purist. Romero's vision is what I think of when I think of zombies. You know, these infected, you could just shoot them. You don't even have to give them a headshot. But here's the thing. It is about that apocalyptic vision, that world in decay. And I think Romero, especially with like Dawn of the Dead, really sold that. And that's what's scary to me. Like whenever I see society in decay, like to me, that is a horror film. I don't know what it is. I don't know what I saw early in my youth that made me so scared of like just seeing social mores crumbling and people turning on each other. But that's what scares me. And I think that's really what is at the root of many zombie films and the zombie lore. Is man turning against man, and we definitely get that here.
Yeah, it's a zombie movie in the way that Richard Matheson's I Am Legend is a zombie movie, which some people call a vampire movie. But by taking it into the realm of disease, I'm more terrified of that than zombie. Honestly, maybe because it's got real world applications, maybe because some of these zombies transmit like Ebola or something, but I get more freaked out by hot zone kind of stuff than horror stuff these days. Contagion is a great scary zombie movie in a realistic sense, because this could really happen. I'm not saying this movie could really happen, but our annihilation really could come in the form of a spread of a communicable disease. And so to look at the zombie genre through that vantage point, I think you're really milking it to be as scary as possible.
That I agree with. But to me, my memory of zombies were that they were always caused by some kind of contagion. I mean, I hadn't really seen the Night of the Living Dead films when 28 Days Later came out. I had seen, as I mentioned, the Return of the Living Dead films. And what starts the zombie plague there? Government experimentation. A gas is released that causes the two guys who work in the medical supply factory to become sick, and they are infected. They die and come back, and they are zombies. To me, zombies starting by a virus was very natural. I think the biggest example of this was the Resident Evil games, which I did play in the 90s and the new millennium, and that is also zombieism started by a man-made virus.
Ah.
So to me, infected or virus, I didn't see much of a difference.
Yeah, tomato, tomato. At the end of the day, they're dead people that are getting up trying to make you dead.
Well, not in this film. I mean, they aren't the dead. They're the living, and they die pretty easy.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way.
Right, they never die. A shot to the stomach kills them. You kill them like any other human. You can debilitate them like any other human. It's just their infection is rage to rip out your eyeballs. But there are some similarities, too, that we'll discuss as we get into it.
All right. Well, then I think we should. Arnie, that's your cue. What's the plot?
A group of scientists are researching a cure for rage. Rage, you know, normal rage, like road rage, things that cause humans to do horrible acts of violence. But in order to cure rage, first they have to create it. So they've built a rage virus and injected it into primates so that then they can work on curing it. But a group of animal activists break into the lab to set the animals free. One monkey attacks a would-be do-gooder, and a drop of saliva, one drop of blood, is enough enough to infect a human with the rage virus. The activists start to attack each other and the scientist who tried to stop them. And then we go 28 days later, where bicycle messenger Jim awakens from his coma to find his hospital completely abandoned, and going outside, all of London seems deserted. In a church, he comes across a pile of corpses and a group of infected who start to chase him. He flees and is rescued by two human survivors, Selena and Mark. The two add Jim to their group, and they try to go to Jim's house, where they see his parents dead in bed, having committed suicide as the infected rage on. Mark is attacked and becomes infected in the house, and Selena chops him up with a machete before he can turn. Alone, Mark and Selena see Christmas lights in a high-rise. They investigate and meet cab driver Frank and his teenage daughter Hannah, and Frank heard on a radio that a military blockade near Manchester has supplies and the answer to infection. They decide to make the trip, there's many scares along the way, and upon arrival, Frank gets a drop of infected blood in his eye, but he's killed by military troops stationed at the base. Jim, Selena, and Hannah are taken into the base, and it's revealed that their leader, Major West, had made the recording and promised his men that women would come. The plan was to have Selena and Hannah become recreation, shall we say, for the men, whether they wanted to or not, and when Jim and Sergeant Farrell oppose, they're taken out to be shot. Jim escapes, Farrell does not, and Jim returns to the base as feral as any of the infected, killing several of the military himself and releasing a captive infected upon them as well. He rescues Selena and Hannah, but is shot by Major West, who is then killed by an infected. And, 28 days later, we see Jim recovered from his gunshot wound, living in the country with Selena and Hannah, and a recon plane flies overhead, showing that global civilization is not gone, and the plane sees their makeshift sign for help as credits roll.
Or at least in one version. There's a couple different ways they could have ended this, and some of them were even theatrical. You know, I did something I never do. I not only saw 28 Days Later in theaters, I saw it in theaters twice. They re-released it with a different ending, and I went back partly because I was with people who hadn't seen the movie and I had talked it up, but partly because I wanted to know what could happen with the ending. What could they change about it? There's a lot of different ways, and I think when we get there, you're going to see radical different vision about how they could make the third act go.
I remember when that new ending came out, it started overseas, they brought it here. This was the first time I'd ever gone to YouTube that found the alternate ending instead of going back to theaters, because I will say this, I said I was excited to talk about this movie, and I am. This is my first time watching it since theaters.
Wow.
No, definitely not mine. I've seen it a couple more times since.
My reason, this movie is harsh. We're going to talk about it as we go through, but as much as I love it, this film is brutal, and I find it hard to watch sometimes. It takes me on an emotional roller coaster that isn't always pleasant.
Interesting, because that's one of the biggest draws for me is the brutality that we'll get into this. But I guess we'll talk about it when we get there.
Yeah, there's a foreboding that hangs over this movie that goes beyond genre horror. Lots of horror movies show us something scary, monster, rah, rah, rah. This is a world almost without hope at all. In fact, the struggle is to keep hope alive. It's not to kill the zombies. It's not to kill the infected. This movie is an internal battle not to completely off yourself because things have gone so bad. And we get that sense right from the prologue. All we'll ever know about the rage virus, we're told in scant information here, but it's just such a great tease. I wouldn't want to know any more in this first installment than what we get here when they break into the Cambridge Institute.
I was totally fooled by this opening, and it's been a few years since I've seen this. I know it fooled me the first time. It fooled me again. We get this opening of all these different shots from television of the world in decay, riots breaking out, and I thought I'd accidentally put in 28 weeks later that they're showing us footage, because I'm like, no, 28 days later doesn't start in the middle of the zombie apocalypse. That's the next one. But no, total fake out. It's just they're brainwashing these monkeys.
I couldn't remember, but when they pan over and we see, yeah, a monkey strapped down to a table, I really thought I had put in the wrong movie. I'm like, is this Link? Shock Mom? What did I get here? I got the wrong disc, Netflix.
Rise of the Apes.
Yeah, it has a different vibe than what I recall, but a great one. I mean, it's an image we're going to see a little bit later with Jim that replays. I think it's important to start with the sense that the world is already 1 foot headed towards the apocalypse. And, you know, let's face it, monkeys, whenever you introduce monkeys into a scientific scenario, they're our closest relative in the animal kingdom. They sort of represent us in a primitive, primal state. And that's what they're getting at here. They're trying to find that primal rage that we've never gotten rid of out of through all our evolution. It's still with us, and they're wanting to harness it. It's an interesting concept. I wish I could understand more about it, but I respect the fact they keep it pretty vague here.
Well, they're not trying to harness it. They're trying to get rid of it. They're trying to take that away from humans. They say in order to cure it, first they had to create it, though. So it's not like this is, say, like Return of the Living Dead, where they're doing a military application to make super soldiers of rage who will go out and kill everything mindlessly. Their goal is to create a cure for that. So they had the noblest of intentions while creating this dastardly deed. They do this in real life, you know. They create viruses just so then they can create cures for those viruses. And the scare is, what if the virus gets out before the cure?
Right.
And if you do want to know more about this, Stuart, there is a graphic novel, 28 Days Later Aftermath, which came out 3 or 4 years after the film, but it actually starts with the scientist and gets a little bit more. You know, I think the line is sufficient that before we cure it, we have to create it, but it gets a little bit more backstory. I don't think it's totally necessary, but there's that material out there if you're interested.
I am interested, and I'm glad that it exists in a different medium. I wouldn't want that to be a scene in this movie. I love the way that this movie unfolds. I think it's greatest strength is what it withholds and what it's showing us at the time it's showing us, the pacing, all of that. That's really what is so great about this movie. But they've harnessed it so that they can make these monkeys rage-filled. They really are, for the purposes of their tests, right now, just trying to get them angry. That monkey is watching violent imagery to pull it out of him. They're trying to make him angry and violent. They're not trying to cure them at this point. They want to see that they can make them go to this level when the environmentalists bust in here.
I do love that it's pretty much PETA that screws it up for the world, or at least England.
Well, it's both. It's a shared responsibility. I like the fact that it's even-handed. No, the researchers were playing with fire, and they probably shouldn't have been doing this, and it's unethical if you take that stance. But at the other hand, yes, these people were doing nobody any favors by blindly opening cages.
One of the things that really sells me right away, these animal activists, they come, they open these cages, the girl gets bit, and the camera kind of pulls back. You hear things, you see her kind of change. But it goes back and just focuses on this monkey while you hear things. And you see this monkey's face, it's almost kind of just calm. And it just lingers. And one thing I love about horror, leave it up to my imagination. I will think of horrific things going on. And this film does this repeatedly, but it starts off right away just focusing on this monkey's face while all hell is breaking loose.
I think that's what makes it worse.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm imagining awful things at this point.
Yeah, one of the things I love about this movie, and it is throughout, and it starts right in this opening scene, their sound design is so incredible. The way that they use the vocals, the sound effects, the music, and silence in this film. And so you're seeing this monkey's face, but you hear god-awful things. And that is very effective in this movie. It starts right away. And here's also where I start thinking about the zombie connection, because it's one drop of saliva, one drop of blood. Basically, if they bite you or if they bleed on you, because they regurgitate blood, which is horrible.
It really is. It gets me thinking into real viruses, Ebola. You know, that's how it transmits. You actually barf, and then whatever that comes in contact with, they're infected too. It's got a real world nightmarish quality to it, even though it's this fantastical, almost Hulkian kind of red-eyed condition. Once they are fully infected, I mean, you can tell just by looking at them because they have red irises. Were you thinking of Banner at all, Arnie?
No, actually I wasn't, and that's a credit to this movie that it sucks me in and I don't start thinking about other movies necessarily like that. But this prologue is very short. We don't know how it gets out of the lab or how far it spreads. We are just taken right to the titular 28 days later.
Yep, and I just love the match editing of this. I really love the filmmaking that happens here, but particularly powerful is the way that when we're introduced to Jim, our main character, he looks just like that monkey strapped to a table, only he's recovering from a coma that he was put in while he was riding a bike. Presumably he was hit and has been out of commission for the last month, had no idea what has been raging across all of England. And we're also fans of mentioning the titty shot. Here's a rarity, a willy shot. Is this a now playing first?
Come on, we've had to have some male full frontal before.
And I'm not sure we did.
Have we done a Harvey Keitel film? Hey, we saw the super dick of baby Kal-El. Does that count?
It was tiny.
Yeah, I feel like there's something different when it is a baby.
I do remember seeing this in the theaters, and it always seems to be the reaction, you know. No one laughs when there's a pair of tits on the screen, but whenever there's a penis there, everyone just gets nervous, and they gotta laugh. That's how they deal with this nervousness of seeing a penis. And I remember people, like, chuckling at that point.
Yeah, it is a way of really making the character look vulnerable right from the start. I absolutely love Jim's discovery of what's happened. Everything that they have here is just so haunting in what isn't said. The fact that it is abandoned, the fact that things are torn to shreds and that he has no answers, that someone has locked him in here, left him to the best of his own devices and shoved the key under the door. I mean, it really says a lot by what it doesn't say here in this intro. I think the first 15 minutes really are the finest part of this movie.
It's a great 15 minutes. I'm not going to say it's the best part. I think my favorite part is the last 15 minutes. But right here, Cillian Murphy is the only person on screen for so much of this opening. And bravo to him for being brave enough to do the Willy shot. You know, it's gotta be very difficult to do that and to do it and to walk around on set like that and portray this man confused and chugging soda and walking through the streets of London. And
well, he does get scrubbed pretty quick. I mean, it's not a movie about male nudity. They're not doing Life Force here. This is Return of the Living Dead by any stretch of imagination.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it's just him and all the things he's doing. Yeah, he gets dressed pretty quickly, but he is captivating. I had no clue who Cillian Murphy was when I saw this movie initially.
I don't think anybody did. This really was his debut. I mean, he had done maybe some BBC shows and stuff, but definitely not exposure in America at all.
And when I saw him later on in things like Batman Begins, I came to know him, but I didn't realize that was the guy from 28 Days Later, because here he's under that scruff. And to me, he's always played a little bit of an erudite, kind of effeminate character. But here, yeah, I buy him as a manly bike messenger, and it just shows that the guy may be typecast as a certain way, but he has range.
Yet, one of the things that really, I think, sets 28 Days Later apart from maybe other zombie films that I really like is that this isn't just a well-done zombie or infected film. The shots and the acting with Cillian here just by himself, walking around, discovering things. I love the camera work. I don't know how they emptied London to get some of these shots. Did they just shut streets down? It seems like it would be an impossible task for some of the shots they pulled off in this opening 15 minutes. I love the music, the way it just builds and builds and gets louder and then kind of just cuts off. And one of the things I noticed, especially when I saw this on the big screen, when he's walking around London, is the type of camera, I guess, they used to film this. It wasn't all smooth. It was almost like you're watching security footage. And I guess it's because they use, standard definition cameras, digital cameras?
Yeah, this was pretty new. That whole concept of just kind of doing it guerrilla style. I mean, it is how Danny Boyle made Trainspotting. He made it cheaply and on the fly. And his movies always have a lot of energy. I don't really like all of them, but they always have an incredible energy. I always want to see what he's doing. I think he's really great with using the camera and editing to just propulse you into a story. I think that is his gift here and really is serving this opening quite well here. But yes, there really does feel like an indie quality to that. I mean, now we have a lot of found footage movies where it's less rare that we have this jittery handheld style. But in horror movies, it really wasn't that way. And the cameraman here, he had done a lot of stuff with Lars von Trier with Dogma. The whole movement was about doing it with no lights, doing it with minimal frills, no dolly shots. We don't have time to set up train tracks to push in or push out. They really just did it raw and dirty, and it's the way to make this story really pop. It really would feel very, very different if they did it in wide shots and had a lot of money to do cranes and what have you. I like its gritty indie vibe.
I agree. And if you want to know more about how they cleared the streets and things, Jacob, definitely check out the commentary, because I had the same freaking question. Every time I see this movie, I'm like, is this real? Is this green screen? How did they do it? just incredible that on a film that definitely feels low budget and feels indie, that they were able to do something so massive as make London, all of London, appear deserted. That is always the most impressive thing to me. You can put Tom Cruise in Times Square, and I believe it. You put Tom Cruise in Times Square and it's deserted, that's an impressive feat. And they pull it off here so well that it's completely real. Now, as far as the cameras go, watching this on the home theater in Blu-ray, I have to say the definition of the digital does not hold up for a high-def transfer. It's grainy, it's got digital noise all over it. It's not a pretty picture anymore. I remember thinking it looked good in theaters, but it doesn't hold up at 1080p. But I love the energy of the camera and the way it's moving. Everything they're doing with it is great. It is just sheerly the technical limitation of shooting digital in 2001, 2002.
Yeah, and I don't think that I ever thought that it did look good. I mean, they use filters, they do things to evoke the mood, but the harshness is what they're emphasizing here. It is never a beautiful apocalypse, if I can put it that way. I mean, we're always supposed to feel like something really ugly is brewing here, even when it's just him walking around amid Big Ben trinkets on the street, even before he goes into the darkened church. It's like a nightmare. I mean, we've all had this nightmare, right? That we're walking around, we can't find anyone, the world feels familiar but abandoned. I mean, I feel like Boyle robbed a dream from my head and projected it for me.
I don't know if that's my nightmare. I think that would be a great time to get some reading done. Oh, I broke my glasses.
That's for the Twilight Zone fans out there.
I get it. And the Matheson fans. I mean, I brought up already I Am Legend, and even though Will Smith will essentially remake this in a few years, this story had already been put to film, and I got a strong Omega Man vibe. You guys ever seen that one? Charlton Heston in the 70s was the last man on Earth living in New York fighting vampires or zombies or whatever you want to call it. They're white people with afros that drink blood. It's a terrifying movie when you're 6 years old, I gotta say. And there's more than one or two references here in 28 Days Later to Omega Man.
Haven't seen it, didn't catch them, but I may have to check that out if it's anywhere close to what this is doing.
It doesn't hold up. I mean, it's a campy movie now. Maybe for fun, I'll go back and review it for the Gazette or something. I have not seen it in a long time. There's a lot of stuff that I remember being terrified now that would make me laugh. It was 1971. Bell bottoms were the fashion statement. You can imagine. But yes, the setup is very similar. If you saw the Will Smith movie, you know what the plot is. But the first half of it is really him alone. And then eventually he gets some friends. He gets a hot pistol pack and black renegade woman to be his sidekick here. I mean, I definitely feel like there's Matheson I Am Legend callbacks that Garland is aware of. You said that he was thinking consciously of Romero. I think he was thinking consciously of that story as well. There is a distillation of what has happened before in the zombie genre.
But pretty quick it moves on. Thinking of zombies, I definitely got a zombie vibe. In fact, I never thought they weren't zombies when I first watched this movie. When he comes upon the church and it looks like the infected are feeding upon these pile of corpses in there.
Yeah, we don't even know what we're looking at. I mean, fortunately for him, he's up on the balcony. He went upstairs, so he probably wouldn't have lived if he had just walked into the church recess. But he's looking down at a sea of bodies that may be corpses, they may be asleep. We don't know. And he says, hello. And man, the look on those two faces, you know, he stepped in it. You know, it's like, oh, I could just foot and mouth go back. Backpedal and not make that noise. I mean, oh, before they're even running, before there's even any rage, just that expression on that agape mouth is enough to chill me.
Yeah, I'm thinking he walks into this church and it's like a Jonestown scenario where just people committed mass suicide, but there is that one infected. He doesn't even move. You just see him. Yeah, mouth agape. Scares the hell out of me. It is chilling.
Yeah.
And then bang, 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 something's at the door up on the balcony level with him. It's a priest. I love that his first fight is with the priest. He feels guilty about it. He's like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. He's blaming himself initially here when the first rage zombie comes at him.
But he doesn't know what's going on. He thinks he just cold-cocked a priest with a bunch of soda.
A rabid priest. I mean, granted, no father would ever behave like this in his own church.
But here's the other thing that makes me think zombie. zombie, the infected aren't attacking each other. They move in packs. Once you're infected, you're part of the club. And that's kind of the zombie thing. Zombies don't eat other zombies. They only eat the normal. Somehow, these infected realize that Jim is normal and they want him. And they're clawing to get to him, but they're not hurting each other along the way. I find that very odd. If you think of it just as rage, you think that they would start by killing each other.
Yes, that is true. It is not nihilism here. You're right. They see themselves as part of the same pack. And I guess they know that Jim has higher cognition. He can speak. They cannot speak. That seems to be the biggest difference, is that he seems to have all of his senses. And maybe that's what makes them angry.
There is some hints in the film that it has something to do with scent. They kind of sniff around. And again, in that comic, 28 Days Later Aftermath, it's kind of comedic, but they do make it more explicit that they smell things that remind them of being human. At one point, a guy covers a tank in perfume so the infected will go attack this tank because they're drawn to that scent of something they recognize when they were still alive. I don't think they really make that explicit in the film, but there is something. They sense something human that's not in them from these other people like Jim.
Right. And Jim's a rarity here. Fortunately for him, there's two other people like him out on the street. He goes running out of the church. His ass gets saved by Selena and Mark, but these people probably haven't had new flesh to feast on for about a week. I mean, that's what we're told. It's been 6 or 7 days since the two rescuers have even seen another living person. The world has changed so radically in the weeks that Jim was asleep in his coma.
The irony is that when these two show up, I kind of like Mark and don't like Selena.
I think it's intentional. I think that there's a gender bias. I think we tend to think of as the tough man as being in charge. Not to say that Selena looks weak. Again, I think Rosalind Cash from Omega Man is the basis here. They want her to look tough, but she's a supporting player, right? She's a psychic. She may be killed. I mean, even horror movie logic. Black characters tend to not live as long as the white characters. I think it's part of the deception Boyle is pulling over us that we think that Mark is the person to listen to.
And you mentioned the comic The Walking Dead. I realized that The Walking Dead started in the States just a couple months after this movie was released in the States. And that's creator Robert Kirkman says he was creating Walking Dead and it had already gone to press when he saw 28 Days Later. But there's a lot of similarities. First of all, they both start with somebody waking up from a coma in a hospital. And when they went into the coma, there were no zombies. And when they come out, zombies have taken over the entire world and they can't find anyone. Same exact setup. And later on in The Walking Dead, long after this movie, he'd introduce a sword-wielding, bad motherfucking black woman named Michonne. And seeing Selena here, I get some early hints of Michonne there. Selena's got her machete, and she is tough as nails, and I love her.
Totally, Arnie. I was thinking the same thing. I was a fan of those Walking Dead comics, and I know that Michonne character came out much later than this film, so maybe they were created at the same time, but that character has to have some kind of influence from what Boyle did here in 28 Days Later with Selena.
Yeah, she's every bit as tough as Mark, but we don't realize it. For whatever reason, we're hanging on Mark to tell us what's going wrong with the world. We find out all that we're ever really going to know about how radio and power and television just kind of went out. There's rumors that it's in Paris. There's rumors that it's in New York. There's just not any information. The whole structure has fallen. How are people to know anything without the internet, without them looking at their phone? I really love the hopelessness that gets created when you take away things we take for granted here in civilized urban environments.
But I'm able to not get it when they're blowing up buildings and giving us a great action spectacle. When I get it is when they go to Jim's house and you see the parents dead in bed having overdosed on pills. That sells the hopelessness to me. When they're saying it, that's one thing. But to see this old woman just in her panties dead in bed, that's when you realize things are a long way from good.
And it's not just that they're dead, something with the makeup, the way they made, I don't know if these were actual people or they're prosthetic corpses, but they look a little shriveled, like they've been sitting there a while. Like, again, the production values here, they sell this story, and just these little details, the way they're withered, really catches my eye and sells it for me.
Yeah, the detail that really gets me is that they died with a photo of young Jim as a boy. They wrote a message just in case he woke up of, now we're sleeping like you, don't wake up. I mean, oy, it's tough, because where do you go to now? Most of these apocalypse stories, in fact, when I look at the trailers for World War Z, it seems to be about a man trying to reunite with his family in a time of crisis. Well, we've gotten that in Act 1, and they're dead. So now what is he going to do? I mean, Selena spells it out here pretty early. The best you can hope for is to just stay alive. It's a dark world.
And if that's the case, you really get why Jim's parents did what they did. If all you can hope for is survival, what's the point of survival? I think that's a big theme that goes all the way through 28 Days Later.
It's what the movie's about. It's not about figuring it out. We know that Jim is a bike courier. He is never going to invent the cure. He is never going to figure out how to stop them. That's not what his journey is. It's a reason to go on in a hopeless world. It's his journey to find hope and maybe inspire it here with Selena and Mark. Uh-oh, maybe not Mark.
Wow, that is ruthless too. And this is where initially I wasn't sure about Selena, because I like Jim. Jim is immediately someone you can click with. And Selena seems willing to let him die, so you don't like her. But when she just hacks up her friend of maybe 6 days, maybe 10 years, he gets possibly infected. There's a wound on his arm. Is there blood in that wound? Is there saliva in that wound? We'll never know, because she just hacks him up.
She overreacted.
No, come on. They set it up. You have 10 to 20 seconds before you turn into an infected. You don't have much time to think in this world. When we were watching Romero's Dawn of the Dead, we had characters that went a couple of days before they turned. No, not here. You have to make split decisions. It sells the nihilism, the brutality of this world. This scene is brutal, and I really like it because it is so brutal, because there is no gray in this world now. This is kill or be killed. They sell it right here.
Yeah, but I do think it's Selena's journey. Her character arc is to realize that, yeah, maybe you can count to five. I think that she's just prone to think the worst in any given scenario. The wrist is open. I have watched this scene many times. I am not convinced it's a bite. I am not convinced that any blood or any transmission from these two infected that burst in the house has gotten into him. Count to five. Let's see if he rages out. Do the eyes change? I mean, I feel like he got a little bit of time to figure it out. But she's just that tough. She's that cynical. Is that I'll just chop him up rather than risk taking those beats to find out whether we can save him, whether he can go on with us. We'll see. At the very climax of this movie, she has a change of heart.
Yeah, I agree with you, Stuart. I would wait for the first twitch. You know, you can take preventative actions, like get some zip strips off a dead cop and handcuff him or something. Don't just immediately machete him. And again, brutality. It's not one slice of the machete and he's dead like Jason. She takes off his fingers, then his arm, then he's still screaming behind the sofa as she keeps chopping him up.
Right. And I want to be clear. This is what I hope for the character to figure out. I love the scene. I love that it plays this way. I love that Jim is now partnered with someone this deadly. Because can you imagine how scary it would be? Now I'm scared for the person that's supposed to be saving me, because she might think that I'm infected, and the next thing I know, I have no head. I mean, you really wonder, how many more minutes am I going to be able to breathe with this is my savior, and the world is populated with these people, that my next door neighbors are now rabid monsters, and that everything that I knew is dead. Just bleak. And the only beacon of hope? Christmas lights. That's what brings them to the act two of this story.
And of course, along the way, a great chase and up that stairwell. I've seen Marjorie do this thing. It's called the fight for air climb, where she does 30 flights of stairs in a row up a hotel. And I know how hard that is on your lungs, having seen her do it in person. And to see Jim, who is, they call it out, he's in good fitness because he's a bike messenger. But since waking up, all he's had is sugar and exhaustion. He didn't even sleep the night before. She's ready to leave him breathless in the stairwell.
I mean, how many days did he go without food even before that? He would be in a weakened state coming out of a coma. I mean, he hasn't eaten solid, proper food for who knows how long, maybe 28 days. I think he'd be dead, but it could be a week. I mean, he could have had nothing but intravenous fluids for quite some time. Even if you're a fit person, you wouldn't be able to run for too much longer. I mean, he is dead meat, and we know she'll leave him if he slows her down. I mean, she's made that abundantly clear. She is out only for herself, and you can tag along as long as you're not a problem. Again, I'm feeling for Jim in these moments. I like Selena, but I'm scared of her.
Again, I think that's one of the great things about this relationship here, is that tension, that they are not there to help each other. He's just kind of tagging along because this is the one person that can keep him alive, but she's willing to kill him too. She's not in it for him. If he can't stay up those stairs, well, she's going to keep running.
Yeah.
And again, the sound of the infected. And I think one of the hardest things to hear, and horror movies should do this more, is the screams and pleas of someone who may die. His constant screams for Selena to help him and her complete ignoring of them is so hard to watch.
It really is. And, you know, she's not really convinced that the answer is here in flat 157. They get to the top. There's an armed guy. He takes out the infected that are pursuing them, but she's ready to leave Hannah and Frank behind once she gets a good look at him.
I don't know who this actress is that plays Selena. Has she been in anything else?
Not before this that I knew, but we've seen her as Moneypenny. If you followed the new James Bond in Skyfall,
okay.
She is now a partner to 007, and she had a bit part in some of the pirate sequels. I kind of lost interest in those, but she's worked.
Yeah, she became hot.
I did not realize that she was Moneypenny. Wow. Yeah, you're right, Artie. Well, one of the things with Selena that really struck me, or this actress, I guess, I thought maybe she might be like a scream queen in the UK, because when she gets to this door and Hannah won't let her in, like the way she screamed, telling her to let her in, and later when she's just screaming as infected are attacking, she has a really effective scream. It's not just like some run-of-the-mill scream. There is something in her voice that communicates that terror she's feeling.
Again, props to the audio mixer, because I'm watching this with the surround sound. They know when to ramp up the volume. This is a movie that gets you with the jump scare sounds. And when the infected are attacking, they crank it up. They've got Spinal Tap's amplifier. It's on 11. So she may have great lungs. They may have mixed it well, probably a combination of the two, but every sound in here is perfectly effective.
You know, when I think about this movie, if you just stop me on the street and go 28 days later, the very first image that I think of, it's kind of a weird one because it's not connected with the infected at all. It's this image of the goldfish bowl. I think about this goldfish trying to gulp in this tiny little bit of water that's left. They have no plumbing. They're having to throw their poop out the window. Jim's having to shave with nothing but shaving cream, no water at all. I think about that poor little fish. I think there's no better way to signify where these people are at in this story at this point in time than looking at that little fish just trying to hang in there in that little puddle of water. It just haunts me.
And to me, when we first are introduced to Frank there and he's in that riot gear, I'm thinking immediately they found SWAT. They found police. They found people in charge. He's a cab driver.
He's grinning. He's like, let me break out the cream de menthe. He doesn't even have any tough alcohol. Cream de menthe. Oh my God. A little Frosty the Snowman playing in the background. It's just a terrifying moment when you realize these people aren't going to be your savior. You know, it's funny. It plays as comedy because you can just see it. But even before Selena starts talking trash about them, you can see on their faces that she knows she has to get away from this child. They really cannot help her in her quest to stay alive.
I also want to hand it to these two actors. Having the teenage Hannah there, there's an actress I don't know from anything at all. I've seen Frank in some other stuff, but...
Oh, Brendan Gleeson is a very experienced actor. He was in Braveheart, was where he got his start, and Mission Impossible. He's Mad-Eyed Mooney.
Yeah, my go-to for him is the Harry Potter series, so I knew I'd seen him. Hannah, though, it's so hit or miss when you get teenagers in film, but she does so well of playing this kind of scared but kind of resigned person, sort of sad, her fish can't swim, her mom's dead.
Yeah, it is a really good cast. And I appreciate that it's expanded, but not too big. You know, when I think about Dawn of the Dead, that Zack Snyder redo, too many people. When they found the oasis in the mall, there was just way too many characters. Two people in an apartment trying to stay alive with no water. I like it. That's the perfect number to go forward once they find the radio transmission. We're into Act Two.
Yeah, one of the things I think in the most successful zombie movies, it's that idea of claustrophobia. And what better way, you know, stick them in an apartment or a flat, I guess, since we're in England with a few people. I love these scenes where they like go on the roof and they just have like kiddie pools to try to collect rainwater. And
I saw it on TV once. I love that. It didn't work. These guys are hilarious. I know they don't mean to be, but maybe that's why they're funny. They're just desperately hanging on, and the pitifulness of it. I mean, you just have to laugh because it's just too damn depressing.
And it hasn't rained, and I don't know if that's a coincidence or if there's something involved with the rage virus that created a lack of precipitation.
Oh, it never occurred to me on that. I just thought it was a cruel irony that they were in London and there's no rain and he's just cursing his luck.
Yeah.
But it does rain at the end of this. Looking at it from the standpoint of writing, they are building to a big rainstorm, metaphorically, literally. As bad as things are in this moment, things are brewing and it's going to get worse.
I do love this road trip. They get to this tunnel and Jim says what we're all thinking. Go through the tunnel. Obviously a shit idea.
Yes.
But I like that they at least acknowledge this is the worst idea possible. We know something bad's going to happen. Of course, they go driving on top of cars. They kind of have this fun music playing. Ends in a flat tire. The rat swarm. This is terrifying stuff to me. Like, just, I don't know why these rats are coming. It's taken me a second to figure out. Oh, it's because here comes the infected.
I thought the rats might be the infected. I didn't get that the infected was sticking to primates. And I see a horde of rats coming at him. I'm like, oh, shit. How are the rats not going to bite you?
Oh, interesting. I never thought of that.
And just following with all the successes this movie has had as far as conveying horror and the sound mixing, we never really see the infected. We see them kind of in a distance, more shadows on the walls of this tunnel. And a lot of it is them just screaming as they're trying to lift up this little car and change the tire. Again, I don't need to see the red eyes and the blood dripping down. This is scary stuff. This is scaring me.
Yeah, that alien piercing scream that the infected seem to have that no human could ever make. Yeah, it's a great moment. I love it. It's terrifying. But not all these moments are terrifying. I think they recognize they need to lighten the mood. It's been 40 minutes. I don't think I could take any more misery. So it's kind of fun when they get to a grocery store and go shopping and the apples haven't rotted, they're irradiated, and they don't want junk food because that's all that they've been eating. I mean, I'm starting to laugh with these people, and it's a relief, and it's just what I needed at just the right moment.
Yeah, it's a sentiment that would originally have been seen in Dawn of the Dead. We'd see it again in the remake of Dawn of the Dead. But out of all three, I think this one has the most heart. I love the glee with which they're shopping, how they each have a supermarket sweep type cart. How they're trying different brands of whiskey and they're looking at what is good, what isn't good, saying nothing to Cook. And Jim, he's a bike messenger. I think I can eat this raw.
Yeah, I think they don't play this cynically. This isn't like Romero's Dawn of the Dead, where there was all the heavy commentary going on with consumerism. I really feel a lot of this road trip, it is lighthearted. It's almost like this family getting to know each other through a road trip. We have the father, the daughter. We have the, you know, what's becoming a boyfriend and girlfriend. It almost becomes, I don't know, a National Lampoon's European Vacation or something, where we're just watching them drive around the countryside. And it's a very odd change of pace, but it works.
Yeah, the difference is exactly that. In Dawn of the Dead, when characters go to the mall, they lose their soul. Here, I get the sense of liberation. The further they move away from the city, the closer they become. It's almost fun when they're at a picnic and waving at horses and, God knows, somehow having a good time. It's a celebration to know that human spirit can still soar after so much bad.
I like that. There's one thing, and it may be the only ding I give this movie the entire time, is they're out there, Jim goes to sleep, and he has that nightmare that he's alone again. I actually like that, because it's a good scare. Mm-hmm. But it turns out it's a dream sequence fake out, which I don't necessarily like. And Frank is there going, it's okay, it's just a dream. And Jim calls Frank Dad. And it's like they're trying to set up some kind of father-son theme because Jim went to see his parents and they were dead and now he's calling this guy Dad. I don't think it's as fully realized as Boyle might have hoped when he put that in.
Well, there are more scenes. I know that some of the deleted scenes are just of this road trip here and that there's more of them kind of pranking around. You may not have needed it, but I don't know that if I spent any more time with these people, I would ever accept a transference of what's only been a couple days. You know, I don't know. It might be 30 30 days later at this point, since he's found out his parents are dead, and him accepting this new guy as a father figure. I mean, maybe it was said in irony. Maybe he was just having a laugh. It's hard to say, but yeah, I feel like they have all become very much closer and recognize that they need each other, that Selena has even said as much, that she was wrong about staying alive, and that she kisses him. There are things that are happening that make them feel like a family unit. You don't need to actually say the word dad.
Yeah, I agree completely. It's just that one misstep where I'm like, I start looking now when I'm watching it for now playing. I'm like, oh, is there a father theme here? If there is, two watchings for this, didn't quite get it fleshed out. If he was going to go for that, a little more exploration of that theme would have worked, but I do like their bonding. But they're not bonding so close, because in another Dawn of the Dead moment, they stop for gas and Jim goes inside for a cheeseburger and has to kill an infected kid.
Yeah, but I think he really was going in to find someone to kill. That's the feeling I got. They're like, we already got food. And he's like, we don't have a cheeseburger. Like, I felt like he was at this point. He hadn't killed anyone. He needed to prove himself. Selena was getting hot on him. He needed to become the man now, and he was looking for something.
Oh, that's a really interesting take. I wondered why he went into a place that was so obviously fraught with danger. I just took it as curiosity or a needing to know that every closed door held some kind of lore that he couldn't resist. But maybe that is what it is. It is kind of a foolish choice for him to go alone. You never go alone into a darkened place where you know there are infected. And if he didn't know that they were there, instantly he sees a infant dead body and a mother laying on the ground, and people, have they been chewed on? Why are they dead? Were they poisoned? I guess we'll never know, but there is mass death here in this diner. You know to hightail it if you want to be safe.
Yeah, I think I was really freaked out when it was a kid when I saw this in 2002, but now, like you've said in the past, Stuart, it's like, oh, we're going to kill another kid.
It is almost like a shorthand to show a loss of innocence. It is how you show that a character has, yes, gone too far, is losing their humanity. Even though that they are becoming a tighter family unit and finding a high here, the journey is taking Jim closer and closer to his inner rage, and that completely explodes in the climax. But that, yes, this is the first step towards becoming that rage-filled monkey.
The character arcs with Selena and Jim are the opposite. They cross over. Selena's very brutal, and by the end, we're going to see her very vulnerable, and Jim is doing that opposite journey. Arnie said you didn't see him as too effeminate at the beginning here. He's a tough bike messenger with a beard. I don't know. I saw him kind of weak, and as this journey goes on, he starts losing his humanity. He starts getting tougher, gets more callous.
Yeah, I'm with Jacob on that. I wouldn't say tough. I mean, I bought that he was scrappy. I mean, I think of bike messengers as being apart from society to a certain degree, that they don't want to be suit and tie. I got that.
Puck from the real world?
Yeah, or, you know, just a haircut. I've known some bike messengers. I know sort of what the world is. It's a subculture, and he embodies that. But I didn't think that it was so far that I felt like he was, you know, in life a civil disobedient. I didn't get the sense that he was a juvenile delinquent or did horrible things or mugged people. You know what I'm saying? I believe that he's probably a good guy at heart that just had a punky attitude. Totally random side question, but the sign reads, last cheeseburger for 60 miles. Aren't they in England? Wouldn't it be kilometers?
I didn't catch that.
I didn't either.
And he's got a baseball bat. I didn't know that they did baseball over there. So many things I'm learning about England.
Could that be cricket?
Yeah.
No, cricket's very different looking.
Yeah, cricket mallet, I would buy that more, but who knows? Our fans can correct me on the forum if indeed England loves baseball and translates things in miles.
Pretty sure you're not wrong on that one, but it is strange, as this was, you know, made in England, and that is anachronistic. Maybe the place was owned by a Yank.
I was going to say, maybe it's, you know, we got these little Danish towns and, you know, maybe it's a little American town.
Maybe they were told they needed to put that in for an American audience. I don't know. But this is really refreshing. I do want to celebrate this. So many horror movies that we do are set in America, are told by American directors. It's really fun to go to England and to see an American genre done by the English. I enjoy being here in the countryside. It's a nice novelty.
I do like that, and they use it to great effect when they get to Manchester, which I primarily know from soccer and Manchester United. And
oh, don't upset some of our fans.
I'm not saying I'm a fan. I'm just saying I know them.
I think about the music scene. I'm like, oh no, the Stone Roses are burning. Oh no. So happy Mondays!
That is a long ass pan to that burn, though, isn't it? It makes me constantly look at the ceiling of my theater room. Like, show me! Show me! Are you not going to show me? You're telling me Manchester's on fire? And then they finally give it to me, but I'm hungry for it when they give it to me.
I think that's good!
Oh, I'm praising them and saying that.
Yeah, I thought it was a budget thing. I thought they didn't have the money to do it, so it was a relief to know that they did. This movie's sly like that. You think because it looks so dingy that they got no money. The truth is, it's a fairly well-funded independent movie. They just like to keep it grimy for the scariness of it.
Yeah, they even have a few explosions going off. It's not just smoke in the air. You do see some explosions when they show Manchester finally.
Yeah, this ain't Blair Witch Project. This isn't people with no money going out there and just guerrilla style. I mean, I think it had a budget of about $2-3 million. And, you know, that was a lot for this kind of production. And they use it well. They clearly know how to give us what we need in exactly the right increments. Again, that's my highest compliment for this movie, is that it's always telling me what I want at the right time. Manchester's where the road trip ends, and it's also where the clear storyline ends. There is an alternate ending that plays very, very different. It wasn't unfilmed, but it was planned. I don't know why, but there was a feeling that the third act of this movie could have been radically different. I've got to ask, do you guys go with the third part of this story when it becomes, well, Day of the Dead, when it's about going to a military complex and finding out that the humans are worse than the infected?
It's my favorite part of the film.
Yeah, right there with you, Arnie. This is what sells the film to me, what's going to happen in this third act. It's hard to imagine another path that would be as effective as this, because this is why I love this movie. This is why I've gone back to it for this third act.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the thing for me is, up until now, we've had a good movie, but this third act elevates it to greatness. It really does. It's a totally different scene, because for the first two acts, it's been all about escaping the infected. And what I love about this movie is the third act is totally different. It's not about curing the infected. It's not about escaping a larger number of infected. How many times have we seen that in how many zombie movies where the climax is more of them? Here, this movie completely changes. We've basically had two acts of man against nature. Now let's have an act of man against man and see exactly the brutality that will become us in a post-apocalyptic world like this. Love every bit of it. I did see the alternate endings. We'll talk about them after the real one, but I love the one that they've given here, and it is what burns this movie into my memory.
Oh, interesting. I feel like this ending, while I accept, is lesser than the first two-thirds of the movie. It has its own logic, but I don't necessarily feel like the road trip was building to this moment. I guess if you look at it as a story about keeping hope alive, they've built us up a little. This surrogate family has formed, and now we have to lose Dad. Now Frank is going to mess up. They get to the Manchester barricade, and no one is there, and he starts beating on a body with a stick to get a crow from stop picking on a corpse's eye, and it ends up splashing his eye. Talk about tough scenes. This is definitely one of the toughest ones for me, watching Frank have to turn in front of his daughter.
Yeah, what really sells this is the way the actor, Frank, plays this. Just the way he starts rubbing his eye and twitching around. And when he says, Hannah, I love you very much, keep away from me. That sends chills down my back. Again, a lot of this horror stuff, I watch it and it's there. But this stuff unsettles me when I watch it every time.
I like that, Jacob. And what I also like is he apologizes because he kind of went off on them and he gets that out. But then he says, get away from me. And you know, that's Frank. And she goes towards him and then he starts to scream, get away from me. And to this day, three viewings in, I don't know if that's Frank talking or if it's Rage Frank. And he's full of rage because she's not doing what he says. Like, he's half converted at that point.
Yeah, it's just such a nightmarish one. I remember being in the theater and making noises myself and hearing others around me, like just variations on, it just rips my heart out here. It's just painful. You're worried for her, but the worst has already happened. with Frank turning, it's what breaks Selena. You know, she was softening, but now that this guy gets put down, what is there to live for? She was always the character to look for new horizons, and I think she was starting to identify with this young woman and her dad. I think she was transferring that to her relationship with Jim, but what is the point of living if people are just going to be gunned down?
And again, it's up to Jim to put Frank down. He's got to go do it with the baseball bat. They're looking to him. Selena isn't going after him with the machete. And what's Hannah going to do? It's Jim who has to walk towards Frank, but then he's saved from it by the military.
Right, yeah. He should be the one to do it, but he hesitates. Is that a weakness? Has he not gone far enough? Well, he'll go further, but maybe his instinct was right. I think when we talk about the alternate ending, we can talk about all of this. But this is where that alternate ending would begin. It's a widely different take on the rest of the movie. One that I would have liked to have seen, not necessarily to replace this one, but just by contrast.
Frank's death, it shows that this is not your typical zombie. We see him get shot. It's not a brain shot. He doesn't rise up from the dead. Yes, they bite and they transfer their virus, but with Frank's death, because it is just a simple shot to the chest and he doesn't get up, this is where it tells me these are different than the zombies we've been discussing for so many shows.
It seems like each act has a father. The first one was a literal priest. This one was a literal biological dad. And now we have, stepping into all of this, this father of these wayward boys, this commander. I believe Arnie and G.I. Joe, you called him the ugliest man alive? Christopher Eccleston returns to the plan.
I did say he was really hideous. He's not here, so I guess they went to great lengths to ugly him up on G.I. Joe.
We just didn't want to feel good about liking Destro, I guess.
He's also got his start with Danny Boyle. It should be pointed out, Danny Boyle's big breakthrough, Shallow Grave, he was the star of that movie. So it's kind of a homecoming for him to be here in this third act, to be really the malevolent evil. I mean, rage people can't help it. They're infected. But this guy makes choices, and that's what makes him so dastardly.
Yeah, I really like him here. I wish he'd brought a fraction of the menace to G.I. Joe that he has in this film. Because right away, I don't trust these military people. Before I know anything, I know they are not salvation.
Well, yes, that's clear. I think we are to know that. We're looking for reasons to validate that. You know, they're playing around with the car, and they're not very concerned about the fact that Frank died. You know, they serve dinner, and they just speak very callously in front of a girl that's just lost her father. But they're not awful, and yet at no point do I not think that they're going to be awful. I know they're going to prove me right and be the worst representation of humanity at this point. I think it's when I see Major West drinking the dad's whiskey that I know that I really shouldn't like him. The fact that he's appropriated what the dad took from the convenience store, is making it his own, is really grooming these women to be his own. I can start to feel him, like, take control over the family unit. It's unsettling. We always get a bad vibe from this guy. He says it. I mean, we must be a real disappointment to you. Yes, you are. You were not what we were hoping to find when we drove all this way to Manchester.
Yeah, I didn't even catch until a second viewing that that was the dad's whiskey. I mean, they're in this big base. I just assumed they'd have their own liquor, but they spent so much time in the grocery store picking the whiskey that the second time I'm like, oh, that's the same label. That's a yes. Nice, subtle touch.
Yeah, they're really carpetbaggers. They're taking the things that Frank had and making it their own without any real sense of remorse. And that includes his daughter.
This is where it gets real unsettling when you find out what they're there for. I mean, first of all, they're not at this barricade. They're at a mansion. You talk about taking this whiskey. You get the feeling that they just came and, oh, you know what? We're sick of standing out in the rain. Here's a real nice house. Let's just go take that over and live there. You get him. At one point, he's like, yeah, we're not here to really get a cure. We're here to rebuild society. And ooh, that's when I know something creepy's going on.
The real confirmation. I mean, the smoking gun, as it were. They got a bug out back. Chained. A black man chained at that.
Yeah, as a pet.
Yes. One of their own has been infected. We're not exactly sure why, but rather than put him down or do anything humane, they've kept him alive to see how long it will take for him to starve to death. I guess you can see that as a scientific experiment, but it really looks cruel. It really looks like an awful, awful thing to do to a fellow soldier.
I'm actually interested in that, though, to know if he will starve to death. Because if he starves to death, that means the infected will eventually go away. If they never starve to death, that means somehow the infected don't have that way of dying and can be out there eternally.
I know, it's a tough one, but can you really endorse what they're doing here? I mean, it's just the imagery of it. To see him chained, screaming, clawing at the air, you just want to put a bullet in him. You just want to end his pain. If you ever knew him as a person, how could you let him exist in this state, even though it might serve a scientific good? I guess that's why I'm not a scientist. I couldn't do it to those cute little lab rats.
But this was the final Romero callback, because the writer had clearly in mind Bub.
Yes.
And did you want to see Bub put down? I didn't think Bub needed to die. Bub was learning how to use a gun.
Yes, but Bub was being groomed to be humane. This guy is just waiting to die. There's no hope that he'll ever be cured. They just want to learn if they have a shot at starving the forest out. All of Manchester has been driven out by the fires. They now live in the forest that surround them. They've had to booby trap the lawn, and every night they've got to shoot down these people. It's the fact that the soldiers seem to enjoy it, that it's a game. There's only one of them. It's Farrell. He's the only one that has any kind of common sense. You know, he wins me over in dinner because he's like, maybe returning to normal is not returning back to human society. Maybe it's humans dying off and the planet returning to normal. I mean, it's a grim view, but he really is the voice of reason amid all of these bloodthirsty, savage, I mean, just the kind of thing that they were trying to cure in that opening scene, or being represented by these soldiers.
I do like that debate. And you mentioned the family unit. Here you get a different kind of family unit, because Farrell is making an impression because he's talking and arguing a little bit. But the one that really hits me is Jones, who's kind of like the deficient mother of the group. He has to cook omelets and he uses rotten eggs and hopes enough salt is going to take care of it. And
even wearing a pink apron.
Yeah. I kind of get the feeling he might have been their bitch without wanting to be when they were lonely.
I definitely get a gay vibe out of West. I mean, he talks about bringing these women here for his boys. It doesn't seem for his own personal benefit. Everything that he does is for his men, and he does have a particular love for Jones. It was Jones that wanted to kill himself. He didn't see a point in going on. That's why they created the broadcast, to bring the women here, to give him hope that they could provide a future of mankind, even if it meant having women bound in sex slavery. But I got the sense that West wasn't into that as anything more than a necessity to keep what he loved happy and hopeful.
Yeah, West even seems to take a liking to Jim. He kind of pulls him aside and tries to convince him of this plan to let the women be used and tell me about the people you've killed, and almost tries to win him over like a father and a son, almost.
The relationship I really see, and what I really see happening in this third act of the movie, is Apocalypse Now. I really think about Martin Sheen and Marlon Brando, and how now that Jim has reached the heart of darkness, here's the voice of that darkness explaining to him what must be done now. And even if it sounds crazy, he has to join in the frenzy and the killing. He has to go savage if he wants to get out of this place.
I had an Apocalypse Now callback too with that and the Brando character. And I started to reevaluate the first parts of the movie to see if I could make other correlations, to see if this was a pastiche of that story set in a modern post-apocalyptic time instead of in Vietnam. And really, I don't see it, but I definitely get that kind of vibe here with the level of madness that is exhibited among the troops, and how this rogue major, he's not answering to any general above him. He is off on his own with these men who are completely loyal to him.
Yeah, if you understand any correlation larger than this relationship to Apocalypse Now, it's that both were journey stories in which a character went into the darkest recesses of mankind's behavior. You know, the rage, what they were trying to find in that opening scene is what we now find pure bare here with West in this third part. He is representation of that primal rage.
Yeah, I guess we just don't have a progression to it, though. If they found other groups of people along the way who got progressively worse, then it would feel more like a correlation. But yeah, they are both, you know, road trip or boat trip stories.
It's Jim having to kill. You know, he had to kill that child. He almost had to kill Frank. he's been heading closer and closer to doing it. It's there, but yeah, it could have been stronger. And again, I say, this ending, while effective, isn't necessarily the last stop in the journey. I didn't feel like we were destined to be here, unlike some road trip movies where you can't conceive of an ending different from what is provided at the end. Here, I feel like this is a strange journey, and that had Selena got her wish, had they been able to escape and go on, I would be curious to know where else they might find, but the movie does climax here, and it is because Jim is not allowed to go forward.
They have a strange tact. You'd think maybe try to reason with the women, try to romance the women. No, we're just going to attack the women.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can romance a teenager. I mean, I'm not sure what statutory rape laws are in England, but I'm pretty sure Hannah wouldn't make even that. And there's just no way that you could ethically say that she could be the bride for any of these men. Plus, they're going to take turns. They're not talking about monogamy or marriage or dating or courtship. What they are literally saying is that these two women must repopulate mankind.
I know they said, oh, we're here to rebuild society. I don't know if they were actually planning on knocking up these two chicks.
Yeah, you're right.
I think this was going to be brutal gang rape.
Yeah, it's just awful to think about. And
it is.
As awful as this movie has been, I accept the infected more than what these soldiers are doing. Isn't that strange? But I really feel like the infected I can justify. Well, they've got a disease. There's nothing else they can do. They're impelled to their worst instincts. But these men are rational. These men knew society. And this is what they're choosing to recreate it and to represent it. It's just abhorrent. But I guess that's the point.
And I wonder if part of it is that you can take yourself away from the infected and treat them as fiction, whereas rape is all too real and may hit a bit more close to reality and feel more unsettling for that reason. That's what it is to me. Infected attacking, that's sci-fi. Guys ganging up and raping a girl, that's down the road.
One of the things that I like about zombie movies is that some of the more successful ones, they stop being about zombies at some point in the film and being about humanity, or what is humanity. We saw that with Romero. He had a lot of commentary going on. You know, Dawn of the Dead, about consumerism. And I really like you peel away that monster movie and it's actually something about people. I think here, it's something very ugly. This isn't just a message about how awful consumerism is. This is a very dark examination, you know, of what we can become. A very dark version of Lord of the Flies, you know. It's not just hunting a kid down, calling him piggy. This is going to very dark places.
Yeah, if you strip away all of our cities and all of our culture, everything that we built up and sent us back into apes and whatever we were, this is how we would be. And it's just not pretty. We're fighting for humanity. The struggle remains, how do I remain an ethical, moral being when everything has been taken from us and we're at this savage level? It's an interesting conflict, I'll give you that. But you're right, it's unsettling. It risks losing the horror audience because it takes such a stark, nasty, dramatic turn.
And it does feel like there's no way out. Jim and Farrell get handcuffed to a radiator, the women get taken up and groomed, and pragmatist Selena even seems to go with them. She kisses one of them and is like, just let us get dressed on our own and we'll take care of it. And because she has been so Machiavellian the whole time, part of me wonders if she means it. Like, don't rape me. I don't want to be raped. Don't rape Hannah. Let us do this in our own way and we'll give you what you need.
Oh, I thought she was just trying to get a moment in. I thought when she pulled out pills, they were to kill them. I did not think that she was willing to be a part of this world. I think that she may have been finally broken. By losing Frank and watching Hannah lose her hope, I think she might have finally lost her will to stay alive.
I don't know if you could overdose on Valium or if you try to, how long it takes. But she does say, I mean, we learned earlier she was taking these so she could sleep at night. And she tells Hannah, hey, take these. It's going to make it so you don't care. So whatever her plan was, at least she was looking out for Hannah. She was trying to make it so, I don't know, it wouldn't be as traumatic as if she had her full senses, as awful as that sounds.
Yeah, and I got that. I'm just saying, my range of wondering what Selena was planning just ran the gamut during the scene, because having seen what she did to her friend earlier in the film, I believe this is a woman capable of anything.
Yes.
Was she willing to trade sex for survival if her entire point is to hope for survival? I could go with that. The next thing, is it that she's given up on survival and they're going to kill themselves? I could go with that. And the next thing is just, we're going to have to endure but continue to survive. I could believe all of this from Selena, from the character we've seen this far.
That's right, because Selena has never been our identification figure. We have always gone to Jim and looked to Jim on how to feel. We might like Selena, we might appreciate what she brings, but this is Jim's story. And in his darkest moment, ironically, as he's here in quarantine, that's when he finally has the epiphany that there's no way this contagion could have gotten off England, that it's just impossible to think that the spread would have crossed the ocean, and that these rumors of New York and all of that, it couldn't be true. He's clinging to the idea and refusing to be executed, clinging to the idea that civilization exists somewhere beyond these walls, and he just has to survive long enough to get back to it.
I wasn't sure the first time I saw this movie that I believed it. I know the guy was saying it must have survived, there's no way it could get off the island, we're just quarantined, but it's so much hypothesis that I didn't know for sure if I really believed what he was saying. But when you think about the rage virus, one line he says makes a lot of sense. How can this get on an airplane? Yeah, you got 20 seconds and then you've got a screaming mad person. That airplane is not going to land safely at its destination.
Yeah, hopefully World War Z can clear that up for us. I've seen the trailer.
But Farrell gets shot. That gives him the opportunity to escape. And now he's actually at his lowest point. Out of the frying pan and into the fire. He's in a force full of infected. But when he looks up in the sky, there's a plane. There's still a plane flying. There's still another human being that's not infected, presumably several. So there's still a shred of civilization to hope for. And that's what gives him the strength to really go crazy here at the end.
I love this. When he turns, he really turns. I mean, this gets brutal. This is Jim becoming, I guess, Selena. That Selena we saw at the beginning, hacking up her friend. Now we see him. He's got a cause. He has hope. And we see how far that will push him to save his friends, to get out of there, and how violent he is willing to become.
Oh, but Jacob, I completely disagree with what you just said, because Selena hacked up her friend, and Selena said she would leave anyone behind in a heartbeat. If he had become Selena, he would have left them behind. Jim is still the same Jim from the very beginning. They had that conversation back at the flat where she says, they're going to get us killed. And Jim says, I won't leave them behind. Jim could have escaped and survived if he'd been Selena. He has always been a protector. He has always been the one who will go back for his compatriots. So that is why he goes back. I see it as still the polar opposite. Is he brutal? Yes. Was Selena brutal? Yes. That's the only correlation I see.
Yeah, thinking of this ending as the Apocalypse Now ending, this is kind of just where Martin Sheen realizes he's got to complete the mission. It may be a suicide mission, he may not escape this, but he's going to go full on dark. He's going to get as ragey and crazy as the worst infected. And that's what we really see here. It's a risky move. I mean, by freeing their bub and by allowing the zombie hordes back into the mansion, it could just as easily kill him and Hannah and Selena. He could bring about their downfall, but he's willing to risk it to face off with West. It's really a battle with West about how human society can survive. It would be better to wipe us all out than allow West to have this harem.
And this is the scene I think about in this movie. Stuart, you said you think about the goldfish. What I think about is Jim, shirtless in that rain, that very stylized rain that's almost like a strobe light is hitting it. It is a surreal rain. They've been wanting rain this whole time. Well, here's the rain, and it's this strange alien rain. And he is there, and he has a look in his eyes. He doesn't have the red irises, but he has every bit of rage in his eye. You say 28 days later to me, that is what I see.
Yet so much of this, especially during the beginning of this attack, it's just him looking through the window, watching it happen. And you're right, Arnie, he's got a look in his eye that this dude is crazy. Like, he has lost it. Something has pushed him over the edge. And yeah, he's got the rage, but he's not infected.
Normally, I think of deleted scenes as being the more brutal ones, but they actually keep his worst offense here, whereas a deleted scene passed it off to someone else. But when this all breaks in this complex, Jones, the sympathetic, goofy mom of the family, as you called him, he's about to get away. And in this version, he meets the sharp end of Jim's bayonet. Deleted scene, they had it written that he just let the zombies in and they ate him or bit him or whatever they did to him. But I think it's important that Jim make his kill here. And I think it's important that Jim kills Jones, the one that West loved. I think that that is a message he wanted to send.
Ah, I didn't get that. You know, I never really got that West cared for Jones that much. There's so many guys. There's so many names dropped. I got that this guy was Jones, but when West was talking about a man trying to kill himself, I didn't catch it was this guy.
Yeah.
And so now that makes a lot more sense. I kind of wondered why the poor cook got such a brutal fucking death.
Yeah, it really does need to be Jim here if you're to understand this climax being about Jim rejecting West's vision. Jim wants to hurt West. There's no way to hurt it worse than to kill the guy that West saved from suicide.
See, and the reason I kind of thought with this is Jones is one of the two who has to go out to execute Farrell and Jim, and Jones is the one who kills Farrell.
Yeah.
So that's what I thought it was doing, is Jim saw what happened to Farrell. It could have just as easily been him. That's where I saw it coming from. So I wonder if it's a bit of both.
Yeah, I think it works for both well. And like I said, I'm glad they didn't go with that deleted version.
Agreed. But man, all of these deaths in here are so brutal. He does release the infected, but I think Jim has a higher body count than the infected does in here.
Oh, come on. When he's pushing his fingers through the eye sockets and Selena's just watching like that.
Oh my God.
You can tell what he's doing, but then they pan down and show it.
Yes.
Like brutal, brutal stuff.
It's telling that she couldn't tell the difference between him as a savior and as an infected. She doesn't swing the machete, but it's not because she's sure that he is clean. It's that she doesn't want to act too rashly here when he comes for her after he kills the man that almost infected her.
Yeah, she finally hesitates, which is what she didn't do early on, completing her character arc. But yeah, the fact that what they recreated was rage that is natural inside all of us if pushed too far. It is such an ending. I do love they end on a gag. Yeah. Hannah hits him over the head.
I thought you were biting, not kissing. Yeah.
And of course, she's totally stoned this whole time.
Yes, she's just trouncing around as these zombies are like running around hunting her and totally high on Valium.
Reintroduction of humor again makes me think we're going to get out of this Heart of Darkness. That, the enemy has been vanquished. Let's get out of here. I forget that West is still alive and waiting for them in the car and that he gets a shot in on Jim.
That was a shocker. I had forgotten that from the first viewing when I rewatched it here. I was like, oh my God, because I remembered the last scene. So that he got wounded like this shocked the hell out of me.
Yeah, and of course, the guy that he had chained back up is given the honor of killing him. I think that was the right choice.
I remember watching this in the theater. West gets his. The three of them get in this car. They're driving. They're trying to get away. The gate's locked. Smash into the gate. Freeze frame. People thought this was the end. People were like, oh, like, couldn't believe they were going to end with a cliffhanger like that. And I was the same way. I'm like, what? But no, it goes on.
In the official version, we jump 28 more days later. So it's been another month since all of this has happened at the complex. And Jim is awakening from a nightmare in which we have images of him being resuscitated at a hospital. Somehow Selena had enough chemistry knowledge to keep him alive, and he is among them, helping to create messages on the field. I love that when we first see it, it's a shot of hell. H-E-L-L, on this beautiful, serene, Eden-like cottage here. It's such a jarring juxtaposition. Of course they're spelling hello. Of course they're spelling the first words of he says in the movie.
Yeah, I realize that this ending may be a little bit cheesy, but I am so glad they went with a happy ending. After all of this brutality, these characters deserved a happy ending. And it's a nice note to go out on. This was not a Hollywood, they did test screenings and the audiences didn't like unhappy endings. This was purely Danny Boyle and feeling sorry for these characters after so much he's done to them, saying they needed this happy happy ending, and I think we as the audience needed this happy ending.
Yeah, I did not want to see Jim die. And even beyond that, we're given some indication that they can starve to death. I mean, the plane flies over, and we see some infected on the road, and they're almost immobile. You know, they twitch a little bit. They raise their head to look up in the sky, but it really does look like 56 days later, they're kaput. If they can't nourish and feed on blood, and maybe that even doesn't sustain them, but whatever was keeping them enraged has dissipated, and they're all going to die.
Yeah, and even the ones we see there on this road, they look emaciated. You see their rib cage. They are quite obviously starving, and it's not the rage wearing off.
I think what helps sells this happy ending, if we could call it that, I guess they're maybe getting saved as this plane flies over them, is that this film wasn't all about chopping up bodies and people dying. I mean, we did have that second act where it's a road trip. We have this idea of this positive family unit bringing happiness, and now we have, well, those three remaining survivors of that family unit. So it does seem appropriate. I mean, yeah, some might think it's a little fairy tale, but I do like it because this wasn't all about bleakness. There was this family where they didn't give in to the rage. They didn't give in to the despair. They went shopping together and had picnics and looked at animals, and things were good then. And it returns to that at the end.
That's right. Jim gets in trouble because he says hello in the beginning. The fact that he's still saying hello here in the end lets you know that his spirit's not broken. And I like that as a message. I like dark, bleak visions. But I don't like nihilism. And I like the fact that Boyle looks into the face of evil and still sees something good here.
I think it's a way to end it. It may not have been the perfect ending, but I accept it as an ending. There are others, of course, and one that ran theatrically a month after the release in America, they tacked on a what if, in which they showed a less happy ending going on here.
I was really disappointed. I had thought if that ending that I saw on YouTube was amazing, that I would go back to theaters and I would go see this movie again. When I saw it is basically the same ending with one minor change. I mean, it is the exact same thing beat for beat. It is 28 days later, it's a field, but it's after Jim dies.
That's not the what if ending. I mean, the what if ending is literally his witnessing death, that they pull his body into a hospital. He's actually returned to the place that he started. It's a journey back into a hospital bed in which he'll die. And the girls do their best to try and pump him full of morphine and all of that, but he just dies. And it's for Selena to give Hannah the push to keep going forward. Somehow, so of course, it would be Selena, if anyone, says we have to move on, and they walk down a corridor. That's the ending I saw in.
Okay, that's right, because the endings to this are so screwed up. There's that ending where he dies in the hospital, but then there's another ending that tacked on after that, which was what I just described. 28 days later, Hannah and Selena see the airplane just like they do with Jim, only it's without Jim because he died in the hospital. It was an extended version of the what-if ending. So
that said, I like it better than the what-if end. If the last shot is these two women walking down a hallway and the door slamming, it's a different vibe from watching them walk away from a dead body and then finding life 28 days later in a cottage together, sending SOS messages. I think that this third ending is better than the second what-if ending, even if I still, in my heart, want the first one the most.
But then there's the radically different ending, and this was never shot, it was just storyboarded, it's a bonus feature on the Blu-ray.
Not so much a radically different ending, a radically different third act.
Yeah, it's not the conclusion that's changed, it's the final destination. Rather than give us a estate full of raping soldiers, they thought it might be interesting to return to Cambridge. I don't know if they ever went to Manchester or they would change the name of it, but the research facility where that monkey testing was going on is where the last part of the story would conclude. It's certainly a different way to go about it, and I kind of like some of the ideas they have going on here. Essentially, what happens is Frank is bound. Rather than be shot by soldiers, enraged, he's bound and tied up, and they don't know what to do. And Jim is hesitant to put him down by the baseball bat. And they see if the answer might lie in this research facility, where there is still one scientist locked up, holed away, trying to pretend like the world isn't falling apart, that tells them about a transfusion. That solution is you can repair an infected person if you totally replace their blood with someone who's not infected, which in this case would mean Jim dying to give Frank life.
doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Which they call out.
From a scientific standpoint, it doesn't. But from a thematic standpoint, they've been playing with Christ imagery, you know, with the church, with the idea that Jim is here to help and hope and save. I like the idea that he could sacrifice himself to restore the father here for Hannah. I mean, I think that's a nice move. It may have worked. I'm not so sure that this might not have been as good an ending as what we got with the official one.
I don't like this ending hardly at all, the idea of it. I mean, you complained, Stuart, that it's such a radically different third act from what we'd gotten. This makes it even more radically different, and it takes away virtually all action. It becomes a bunch of people in a room talking through a door. It seems so dour, so bleak, and ends with Jim sacrificing himself so an old man can come back and raise a daughter. That's not the movie I want to watch, and I think I would have had a vastly different reaction. The film released, this third act is what makes the movie for me. If this has been the third act, I would probably have fought very hard against even doing a retrospective, and I don't think there'd have been a sequel.
Oh, come now. You're overstating it. There was action. There was infected storming the complex. They had Selena up on the roof doing marksman stuff, losing her soul. I think that they could have made this work. They'd spent enough time with it. It wasn't funded, so we'll never know. Of course, a finished film is going to look better than a bunch of storyboards, but I think you might be short-selling the ideas that they had here. The idea that Jim would be enraged, strapped in front of the TVs like the monkey was in the beginning of the movie, there's a nice symmetry to that. It definitely brings his story to a close in weird, chilling ways that are just as upsetting as what's in the official ending.
I might have gone with it more if it had been Selena giving herself up, because she was the one who started off all about herself and her own survival. If she had learned to overcome it and give herself up for the survival of one of her teammates, that would have been an arc. For Jim to do it, it's just too random. I'm not overstating it because I like the one we got better. I'm stating how I would have felt had that been the ending. It sucked.
It didn't suck.
It was a different way to go. I'll say that. I think as far as the themes of the film go, what we got represented that better. The story about families and these different types of fathers and Jim's arc, Selena's arc, I think it worked better in what we saw. I don't know, maybe in the final version of that, it would have been as satisfying. I don't know, because that was never done. What was presented to me, I like what we got better.
Yeah, I think what we can agree to at least is what we got ain't bad. So what might have been is what might have been, but we can only review what we have here in the finished version.
So Jacob Stewart, do you recommend 28 Days Later? Jacob.
Of course I recommend 28 Days Later. It is a great film. And what really sells it, it's not just the brutality, the blood, the action. That stuff's all great, and that makes an entertaining film. But the craft behind this film is, Arnie, you called out the sound mixing. I mean, how often do we talk about sound mixing, sound editing during a movie? But you hear that in this film and how it enhances it, the camera work, the way it lingers, just not quite on the action. So you create that horror in your mind. I really like that. Danny Boyle creates a film where you participate in the horror, and I always think that's more effective, and that's always more scary, and it involves you more, and that's what I like. I get so engaged in this film, it gets a reaction out of me. Even though I've seen it multiple times and I know where it's going, it's still able to get those reactions out of me, and that's what I want at the end of the day with a horror film. And maybe that's why I don't go to see a lot, because I don't really have that experience too often, but I have it here, and I get into this film, I get drawn into it, I get disturbed, and I highly recommend this film.
Stuart.
God damn the British. Yet again, an American art form taken by them and made better. They did it with rock and roll. They did it with Batman, Christopher Nolan, showing you how to make a superhero movie. Now they do it with Romero. This is the best zombie movie we've ever covered here and now playing. It is a phenomenal experience. Not only does it work as a horror movie, it's just an incredible apocalyptic vision. There are so many movies that try to show you the end of mankind, and I think this is one of the starkest, one of the strongest, truly haunting, scene after scene, a soul-chilling film. And a major comeback for Danny Boyle. You know, he had really bottomed out with Life Less Ordinary and then that costly Leo bomb, The Beach. I think Hollywood had written him off. I think I had thought that he was past his sell date, flavor of the month. He went back to England, regrouped, and came back with the strongest movie of his career. To this day, I think 28 Days Later is his finest hour. It's a marvel. And I really feel like we're finishing off this zombie series. It hasn't always been perfect, but these are some of the strongest works we've ever covered at Now Playing. And one of my strongest of recommends. High, high recommend.
And I agree with both of you. A strong, strong recommend. I said that I hadn't seen this movie since theaters, and it's a movie that I love, but I'm going to continue to not go back to too often, because Jacob, like you said, this gets such a reaction out of me. This movie is hard to watch in a way that very few films are. I would put Requiem for a Dream as another film that I love that is just so brutal to its characters that it is a painful experience to watch, and I don't want that to go away. Every time I watch this movie, I want to squirm. And if I watch this movie too often, if I watched it whenever it was on FX or HBO or whatever channel's playing it, I would lose that. I would become desensitized to it. I would know its every beat. I love that I watched it a decade ago and fell in love with it. And now 10 years later, I'm returning to it. And I didn't remember it. I remembered certain parts. I remembered the rain. I remembered the ending. I didn't remember the thumbs and the eyeballs. I didn't remember the knife in Jones's stomach. I didn't remember who died when. I knew who lived, but Frank, I couldn't tell you when he was going to go. It kept me in suspense the whole way. I hope 10 years from now, I'm able to put it back in again and have these exact same experiences. It is a grand, grand time. You want to see rage? Interrupt me in the middle of this fucking movie, because I am so involved in it, I will be pissed. And Danny Boyle, when this movie came out, I wasn't a fan. You mentioned The Beach, Stuart. I didn't see it. My knowledge of The Beach is the trailer was attached to The Phantom Menace. Leo came on the screen. The entire Star Wars audience booed. I had seen Trainspotting and wanted absolutely nothing more from this guy. I remembered all the buzz around Trainspotting. I saw it. I was like, that's fine. But this made me a Danny Boyle fan to where I will go back and see what else he does. And my greatest joy in life could be if he returned to do 28 months later. I would just love to see that energy and his vision brought back to a post-apocalyptic world. I don't think that will happen. That's why we're reviewing these films.
Yeah, I don't either. I wouldn't hold out hope. But 40% chance, that's what he says.
I don't believe my weatherman when he says 40% chance of rain either. I don't put an umbrella in the car for that.
No.
So, but we will have 28 weeks later next week, which even without Boyle attached, I did see opening weekend, and we will be talking about next week thanks to our donors. Again, you got to take a moment and say thank you, because it is your donation that allowed me to re-experience this movie again. Without doing a donation drive and without people who supported the show and supported the donation drive, this movie wouldn't have been revisited by me. And I can only hope that if you've seen this movie, this podcast has brought a tenth of the joy to you that I've gotten watching 28 Days Later.
Yeah, oddly enough, Arnie, I think you had the similar thoughts about this one that you had about Dark Knight and superheroes. You loved it, but you wouldn't want to consume it all the time. I think for me, this is the penultimate. I wish every horror movie could be this horrifying. I really feel like, yeah, just one of the absolute best. I'm loving being here right now. I can't wait till next week. Thank you, donors. And I really hope you've enjoyed this as much as we have.
So thank you again, listeners. We'll be back next Friday with 28 Weeks Later. Until then, they're dead, and you're going to be next.
We have to leave now. More infected will be coming. They always do.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this episode in the 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later retrospective series.
No, look. I mean thank you.
And I mean show.
Your support helps keep Now Playing on the air.
There are no survivors. It's just us in here and them out there.
The film discussed in this podcast is the property of its respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
What about the government? What are they doing?
There's no government.
Of course there's a government. There's always a government.
The opinions expressed in Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Plans are pointless. Staying alive is as good as it gets.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2013, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Now they won't stop until everyone is dead.
In a church, he comes across a pile of corpses and a coven and a...
Come on, we've had to have some full frontal before. Male full frontal. No one laughs when there's a pair...
Killian Murphy is the...
Cillian.
Killian.
Is it Killian?
We got ripped for that in Batman.
I thought it was the other way around. Okay.
Yeah, Arnie always said Cillian, and then we found out it was Killian. Yeah.
Okay. I thought it was... Okay, never mind.
We've gone both ways. It's so confusing, but it is Killian.
Yeah.
Okay.
For me, it was just very terrifying to realize I'll never hear Frosty the Snowman again and not thank Ricky the Killer.
But Jim did...
Yeah, but... They had that conversation back at the flat. Reviewing an English movie, I start calling it a flat.
Yes. Of course I recommend 20 Days... As I mess it up, it's too late.